Hi, I'm Shekhar Gupta, and I bring to you this podcast version of this week's National Interest. There's been much action around our judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court of India. You've seen this letter that 600 lawyers have written, including Venerable Harish Salve, and then the Prime Minister's endorsement on it, because he has tweeted it and also put a comment on it. That is the subject of our national interest today. As I cut into that, a thank you note to you. Last week, I made an appeal to all of you to take paid subscriptions to the print, and I have to say that the response has been heartening. So those who've taken paid subscriptions or renewed yours, thank you very much. You're marvelous people. We just need your tribe to grow. That said, back to our argument for the week. There's been a flurry of action around India's higher judiciary. First, the letter collectively signed by 600 members of the bar, including the Venerable Harish Salve, addressed to the Chief Justice of India, the letter offered support and solidarity at a time when the court, the signatories say, I'm not saying it, the signatories say, is under an egregious assault from parties interested in undermining it. Now, I'm not using these exact quotes because that becomes too long. I am paraphrasing, I believe, quite accurately. This might have passed as some usual bar politics, particularly when in some states, notably in West Bengal, bar council elections are also being fought on party symbols. So the bar is also divided now. These are polarized times. Everybody's polarized. Why should the lawyers not be? Lawyers, in fact, if anything, are the most politicized, so they also get easily polarized. But this can't be dismissed as one of those polarized bar phenomena. Not once Prime Minister Narendra Modi has endorsed it too. He shared the text of the lawyers' letter of support and solidarity for what they see as an endangered judiciary with an interesting comment that 50 years ago, Congress demanded a committed judiciary. He brought up the era of 1973 and then 1977, when Indira Gandhi's government, Indira Gandhi actually was at the peak of her power then, with a majority much bigger than what Narendra Modi has now. That government carried out two significant supersessions in the appointment of the Chief Justice of India. Each decision was politically motivated and loaded. In fact, each was directly linked to a significant order of the top court in that fraught decade. The first, April 1973, was the supersession of the three senior most judges, Jaishankar Manilal Shelat, A.N. Grover and K.S. Hegde, and the appointment of Ajit Nath Ray as the CJI over their heads. The three who were passed over resigned, as you would expect. The context was the Keshavanand Bharti judgment, in which a 13-judge bench determined 7-6, 7 in favor, 6 against, that there was something called the basic structure of our constitution. Ray was among the 6 who said no. The 3 who were passed over were obviously among those who established the basic structure of the doctrine. The 3 who were passed over were from the 7 who said there is a basic structure. The 3 were passed over because those were senior to Ray. So Ray, the senior most among those who said there was no basic structure, was made the Chief Justice of India. That was the first of these big attacks on the judiciary by her. Generations of Indians, meanwhile, have to be grateful to the judges who said that there is something called the basic structure. That is something that even the BJP is committed to, and that is something the Janata Party, of which the Janasangh then became a member, also was committed to. The second intervention came in January 1977, not long before the emergency was withdrawn. But Mrs. Gandhi, being Mrs. Gandhi, wasn't going to let the most inconvenient judge for her to go unpunished. Justice H.R. Khanna was now passed over and M.H. Baig appointed CJI instead. Khanna resigned. He would have seen the writing on the wall after the 1973 supersessions. He had been one of the 7 who held the majority view in the Keshavanand Bharti case too. More importantly, despite having read the writing on the wall, he was the lone dissenter in the odious emergency era habeas corpus case known as the ADM Jabalpur case, where 4 of the 5 on the bench accepted the Indira Gandhi government's emergency view, or the emergency Indira Gandhi government's view on the curtailment of civil liberties. Khanna never became the CJI, but he emerged among the most iconic Indian judges ever, probably the most iconic. The judges, Mrs. Gandhi's establishment believed, were not in tune with her socialist times as mandated by her voters. I have a majority. I am just carrying out the voters' orders. Who the hell are you, judges? You are not even elected. How can you obstruct what I am doing? That was the logic. Her core group in government represented a deeply Sovietized hard left. That's why this lord thought India needed judges who would better understand what she was doing to implement the popular will. They should, in that sense, be committed to the popular approach to governance by an elected government. Because in a democracy, people are sovereign. So why should the judiciary act like they are more superior? They can't play kabab mein haddi. It is difficult to establish conclusively who first came up with the expression committed judiciary, that awful expression and idea, committed judiciary, in Indian politics. However, late Mohan Kumara Mangalam, a known communist in Indira Gandhi's cabinet, is widely credited with having first floated the idea of a committed judiciary. One obsession of dictators is to have perfect institutions in the belief that only they are capable of creating and protecting these. I will give you a little side story on these. There was a time when I wrote a bunch of articles calling General Musharraf a dictator, and he caught hold of me at some event once and said, "You are completely wrong. I had thought that your reading is Pakistan is good, but now I changed my opinion. It's completely wrong." So I said, "What have I said wrong?" He said, "You keep calling me dictator. I am not a dictator, because in Pakistan under me, the judiciary is the freest. The media is the freest. Everything is the freest ever." So all dictators think that they can create the most perfect institutions. Mrs. Gandhi tried making the judiciary a perfect one with her supersessions. This is the phenomenon from 1973-77 that the Prime Minister was referring to in his tweet. The question that would follow, who is it that is trying to bully and browbeat the judiciary today? I take those expressions from the Prime Minister's tweet, which you can see on your screens, because he said it's been the habit of the Congress party to bully and browbeat those opposed to it. Surely his tweet, the Prime Minister's tweet, suggests it is now the Congress. If that was indeed the case, it would be punching way above its weight, like say about three times, if not four times, given it's only 52 seats in the Lok Sabha. That would be the kind of clout you would think that the Congress has, that today it can also bully and browbeat the Supreme Court, that is Congress or people aligned with it. There is no such thing as a perfect institution in a democracy. It follows, therefore, that the Indian judiciary is far from perfect as well. Has it been getting more imperfect than usual lately? That would depend on how you define lately, which in turn would also depend on where you are coming from, what your politics is. If you were on the anti-Modi / BJP side, for example, you might say the time the Supreme Court really lost its way was in the era of the scam mania under UPA 2, say between 2010 and 2014. This is when the lordships were issuing orders, some purely verbal, more or less proclaiming all influential accused as convicts, taking direct supervision of scams like the 2G spectrum in telecom. There was so much anger in the spoken word on the bench then that it taught so many of us, innocent non-legal folk like us, the expression obiter dicta. That is an order that judges give verbally. Do this, do that. My favorite one is something at that point that one of the judges, one of these eminent judges, who was then hailed as a great corruption fighter, something he said to Ghulam Bahanbati, who was then the Attorney General of India. He said at one point, "Please go and tell the Prime Minister, we are getting angry." I am sure Ghulam Bahanbati, if I knew him well, was already quaking in his shoes. He was among the most pacifist, most non-combative senior lawyers that I have seen, and I should know. I have hidden behind him several times in difficult cases because he used to be the lawyer for the Indian Express, which I then edited. So that is the view from one side of the fence. If you were on that side of the fence, you would think that is where lately begins. That's where the judiciary started losing its way, or the Supreme Court started losing its way. For one not really so bothered about politics of the day, and with all the biases of a cricket nut, I might think that the Supreme Court really lost its way later when it waded into managing, and I'm still scared of speaking the truth, but what the hell, eventually and inevitably mismanaging Indian cricket with its "your daddy's strongest" takeover of the BCCI. It did zilch for Indian cricket, but enriched a legion of retired judges, civil servants, even one army three-star, maybe thrown in for diversity. If you are with the BJP, however, or if you are the BJP, when would you think that lately was? Reading this letter alongside the Prime Minister's endorsement, it would seem that time is now. Is it with the judgment on anonymous electoral bonds? I'd be intrigued. That could be one trigger, even though the information these revealed isn't so one-sided. Everybody has benefited from these except the left, and everybody was complicit in their secrecy. This has, however, raised important points like the link between the action and raids by agencies and/or regulators on companies and the timing of their payouts. Those questions are now being raised as people are able to align data of bond purchases and also bond payouts and encashment. Read the lawyer's letter carefully for some pointers to what might have provoked this. This rear guard, because it coincides with the beginning of the election campaign, but an almighty one. A rear guard action in defense, but an almighty one, with full state support. The references to the court's unnamed enemies, making insinuations of bench fixing, arguing in the court during the day and campaigning in news TV debates later in the evening to put pressure on the judges, criticism of individual judges and judgments are all to be read together. There is a particularly interesting and intriguing line about lawyers criticizing some politically but defending them in courts. Can you fill in the blanks here? Check who the most prominent opposition politician is in the courts these days and who's his lawyer and which political party does that lawyer belong to. And have you seen certain political litigants withdrawing their cases from certain benches, maybe in the hope of finding an odd judge changed in the course of time? That might be the reference to bench fixing in this case. There is much that the letter gives us to mine deeper, think and debate. On one thing there is no doubt, that this has the government's fullest support. The judiciary, the thought is under perilous threats. And this section of the bar and the executive are united to protect it. It is finally now for the Supreme Court to decide if they really feel so imperiled. And if so, is the threat for whoever these non-state actors are so serious that they would need the executive's support? That will be some turnaround from the scene 50 years ago when they were fighting Indira Gandhi's executive.